I read him a bedtime story. And at the end of the bedtime story, there was a prayer. And, you know, I started to read the prayer. And when I got to God, he looked at me. He calls me Mama, too. You know, he says, Mama, I don't want to talk about God right now. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because he has my mother.
Patricia Drews is one of an increasing number of grandparents stepping up to raise their grandchildren due to our nation's drug epidemic. Her story hits hard. Her daughter's life was cut short by a drug laced with a deadly dose of fentanyl, a scene all too common in today's world. She vividly remembers the moment she got the call saying her only child was dead.
I immediately threw my clothes on. All I could think of, I had to get to my child. I had to see her. I had to hold her. I had to tell her that I was there and that it was going to be okay, that Mom was here.
In this emotional episode of Grieving Out Loud, we sit down with Patricia to talk about why she thinks her daughter turned to drugs, how she's dealt with this tragedy, and what she's doing to turn her pain into progress through legislative initiatives. I'm your host, Angela Kenneke. Let's dive into this conversation that will hopefully leave you inspired to also make a difference. Patricia, welcome to Grieving Out Loud. Thanks for being here. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You lost your daughter, Heaven Lee. Lee was her middle name. Your only child.
Right.
Tell me about her name.
When I was 16 years old, I read a book, and it was by V.C. Andrews, and it was Flowers in the Attic. And when I read that book and I saw that name, I knew then if I ever had a little girl, that that's what I would call, that I would name her. When she was born, my ex-husband, her father, he was like, oh, she's going to get picked on. You can't name her that. I said, I'm going to name her Heaven Lee. And then when she was born and they placed her in my arms, I knew then that I was as close to heaven here on earth as I would ever be.
I felt that way after all my children were born, but probably especially after my oldest daughter, Emily, who I lost, was born.
Yes.
Yeah, that moment was forever etched in our minds and in our hearts.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about her and growing up. What was she like?
She was a social butterfly, is what they always called her at school. She went to school here up to the fourth grade here in North Carolina. The teachers used to say, because I would always dress her, everything had to be just so, and that's the way Heaven liked it. But the teachers used to say they couldn't wait for her to get to school every morning just to see what she was wearing. Everything had to match. It just had to have everything perfect. But she grew up mostly in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and she went to the School of the Arts there, which is the same school that some pretty famous people went to. Leslie Nielsen went to that school. I believe Michael J. Fox and Tommy Chong.
Was that a boarding school then? Did she go away during the school year?
No, I am a dual citizen, born here in North Carolina, but my mother is Canadian, so I had dual status. And when she was in the fourth grade, we wound up moving to Canada.
So it sounds like she was really a great kid. I mean, things were going well. Obviously, she's talented. And what was she interested in? What was she into?
She liked acting, drama. She took that, you know, in school. She was very outgoing. She loved skateboarding and longboarding. When we lived in Edmonton, you know, Edmonton's a pretty good sized city. So Heaven was accustomed to having 300 friends to do stuff with all the time. And she loved to get out of the city as well. And she loved hiking. She loved ice fishing. She was very versatile. And one thing she did do, she played a didgeridoo. I don't know if you know what a didgeridoo is, the long thing the Aboriginals play.
Oh, yes. I do know what that is. Now that you've reminded me, I've seen one before and heard one before. Yeah.
And, you know, she was only 5'3" and she weighed 105 pounds. She never got bigger than a size 0 her whole life. Never even made it up to a size 1. She was tiny. But she wanted to learn to play the didgeridoo. And someone told her that only Aboriginal males could play a didgeridoo. And that didn't sit well with Heaven. You didn't tell her that she could not do something. So anyway, she went on to master the didgeridoo. And I never could blow the thing.
But the determined, smart, social teen was on the verge of some major life changes. At 18 years old, her family moved back to North Carolina, where she would experience significant trauma that would change her life forever.
She had lived in Canada for years and was allowed to live as a Canadian citizen until she was 18. So I applied for her citizenship, and they said that they no longer offer second generation citizenship. Although I am a Canadian, my mother's Canadian, I have sister, that lives in Canada, half my whole family lives there. I could not get her citizenship. So we wound up moving back to North Carolina. And when we moved back, I told Heaven, I said, Heaven, choose your friends wisely. She never left the house. And my thing to say to her was, have fun and make smart choices. I always wanted to make sure she made smart choices. That was our thing. But she wound up going to a party. And at that party, she was drugged and raped. And from that day forward, things were never the same.
How old was she when that happened?
She's 20 when that happened.
20.
20.
So 2 years after you moved back to the United States. That had to be so incredibly traumatic.
It was. It was. And then, when she went to the hospital, because she was over age, they wouldn't allow me to go back there with her. And how do I say this? Heaven was very pretty. She even wrote a poem, and the name of the poem is Beautiful. And that's the very last thing that she wrote in that poem, and it always makes me cry. She says, after all, isn't life always supposed to be easy for the pretty girls? But when she went to the hospital, they treated her like it was her fault. The nurses did. They told her that they only had one investigator and he would have to come from Fayetteville, and that was like 2 hours away. And they had no idea what time he would be there. And you're going to have to go to court. You're going to have to do this. They treated her like it was her fault. And it just devastated her. And when she came out, and I said, hold on, Heaven, where are we going? What are you doing? And she just boohoo and excited. And she said, Mama, I can't do this. We've got to go. She said, they treat me like it's my fault. If they treat me this way here at the hospital, how do you think they're going to treat me if I go to court? And I begged her. I said, Heaven, we have to stay. We have to do this rape kit. And she refused to do it. But like I said, from that day forward, we were not allowed to talk about it. She didn't want to talk about it. It was like it never happened. And that's why I say, silence deadly, because it is.
What a travesty, though. I mean, how awful for a young woman to be in that position, to be made to feel that way. And then you had no control because she was already an adult, so you couldn't force her to press charges. And I suppose she just internalized all of that. Is that when the drug use started for her, or what happened after that?
Not long after that is when it started. Yes. She actually moved away. She moved 2 hours away. Because she just didn't want to be around any of those people. I mean, we live in a small town. She just didn't want to be around them. She didn't want to see them. She wanted to act like it never happened. So she wound up moving to Raleigh and from Raleigh to Greensboro with some friends.
About a year later, Heaven decided to move back home. She met a new boyfriend. And that's the point at which Patricia suspects her daughter turned to illicit drugs as a way to handle the deep trauma she had been silently carrying.
She started with pills, and then she progressed to harder drugs. Now, this is a child that ate bean sprouts. She was all into yoga and exercise and nature, but it happened.
It doesn't make any sense. My daughter also was a runner planning to run a half marathon. She was into nature. She was a vegetarian. Right. So you're doing all these things to be healthy and take care of yourself, but they're taking drugs for a different reason. And in your daughter's case, it's really obvious what that reason was, the trauma that she carried around with her and she had lived through.
Yes, you're right. I tell people, I'll never forget the day that she called me. She said, Mom, I'm sick. And when Heaven called, Mama ran. That's just the way it was, on until the day she left this world. And she called, I went. Because that was my child.
Yeah.
And when she first called me and told me, she said, Mom, I'm sick. I need to go to the doctor's. Okay, let me get off work. I'll be right there. So I went to pick her up. And she told me then. And she had 2 little pinpricks. And she showed them to me. And I was floored. I was flabbergasted. It's like, what did you do, Heaven? What is going on? And she just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And I took her, wound up taking her to a detox center. I didn't know anything about this stuff. I didn't know anything about these drugs.
Heroin? Was it heroin?
Yes. I just didn't know anything about it. And I thought, God, this stuff went out in the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, I was just as much in the dark as you. I mean, I didn't find out till after my daughter died that she was using heroin, but I would never have imagined, like, in a million years.
Yes. This child that had to fight to give, you know, her flu shot every year.
Yes, same.
I mean, hated needles, hated anything to do with it. And so we wound up taking her to a detox center, and we went in, and, you know, I'm thinking that we're the only people in the world this is happening to. And then I see all these other young people in there. And it was just alarming to me, you know, and of course I had to leave her there. And when I left, not long after I left, she left. And I tell people, it was like we had stepped on the road to hell. And it's true. We had. And it was a road that I did. I walked with her every step of the way to the very end.
That difficult road would take Heaven to several rehabs and detox centers, marked by both highs and lows. There were moments when she managed to stay in recovery for more than 6 months, giving a glimmer of hope. Yet despite her efforts and the support she received, the grip of substance use disorder was just too strong.
I shared her in a rehab. She left on January the 6th, 2019, and we're in North Carolina. I sent her all the way to Kentucky because, you know, you need to go far away because those people will just suck you right back in. So I had sent her to a rehab in Kentucky, and someone sent me a message. It was not the boyfriend, but it was someone else. And her case is still open, so I can't call names or any of that, but he had sent me a message that she wanted to come home, and I told him, I says, I'll tell you what. You stay away from my child. I'm trying to save her life. If I wanted her back here on drugs and dead, I'd have her here myself. Leave her alone. Well, unbeknownst to me, he brought her back. I had just gotten off the phone. It was January the 28th, 2018. I had been talking to one of my good friends, and I told her, I said, you know, for the first time in 4 years, I can breathe. I can lay down and I can sleep at night because I know my child is safe. Well, at 10:48 p.m., the phone rang. My fiance, I heard him when he answered, and I heard him say, oh, my God. And that's when he told me, he said, honey, you need to come in here, man. And you know, your mind knows, but your heart's not ready to accept. So I wouldn't get up at first. So he had to call me like four times. And finally, I went in to the living room. He says, you need to sit down. I says, no, I'm not going to sit down. What's going on? And that's when he told me. He said, Heaven's gone. And I was like, gone? She left the rehab. And he says, no, honey, she's gone. No pain in the world. It is as if your very soul leaves your body. That's what it's like. That's the way I explain it.
That's a good way to explain it. It really is.
It is.
I always feel like the ground has just been taken away out from under you.
Yeah.
What did you later learn had happened?
My ex was in law enforcement for 30 years. So they called him and told him, because I immediately threw my clothes on. All I could think of, I had to get to my child. I had to see her. I had to hold her. I had to tell her that I was there and that it was going to be okay, that mom was here. And the detective called back and said that I could not see her, that it was considered a homicide investigation. So I didn't even get to see her. And that's another thing that really affected me, because I think that you should be allowed to see your child. I shouldn't have had to wait 4 days, you know, for an autopsy and toxicology and all that. I should have been able to get to my child.
Right. And I know I saw my child. I was there in the apartment. I held her for, it felt like hours after she was already gone. And that's also scarring.
If you're not familiar with My Daughter Emily's story, you can listen to the very first podcast of Grieving Out Loud, where I explain my 21-year-old daughter's death.
I got a phone call. It was from her dad. He spoke in a tone I'd never heard before. Emily's OD'd, he said. I think she's dead. my mind reeled. Huh? What? I don't remember hanging up the phone. I don't remember starting the car. I do remember driving the wrong way, in the wrong direction, not toward Emily's apartment. Turned around and drove as fast as I could. I got there, and outside was parked an ambulance, and people had gathered. A couple of police cars. The side door to the apartment was open. I ran upstairs, as fast as I could, skipping steps. People seemed to be everywhere, in the hallways, on the stairway. I didn't see any of their faces. As I approached her apartment, there was a police officer standing out front in the hallway, just outside the door. He tried to block me. I said something I'd never said before. In my 30 years of being on television, I had never used this line. "Don't you know who I am?" I said. "I know who you are," he said, "but you're not getting in there." Suddenly, someone made a noise and he was distracted. He turned his head and I bolted on by him. I rushed into the apartment. There were emergency personnel everywhere, firefighters, EMTs, police officers. Emily's dad, my ex-husband, was standing in the living room. I can't even describe the look on his face. Tears streaming down his cheeks. I turned toward her room, where a group of EMTs were working on her. I asked, "Are there any vitals?" They had her hooked up to a machine. They said, "We're breathing for her." "No vitals." I dropped to my knees. I started to pray and pray. For all I knew, I was praying out loud. People were all around me and I didn't care. But 30 minutes later, a man emerged from the bedroom. I think he was a firefighter. And he said, "We can't save her. There's nothing more we can do." That was the night my daughter died.
Opening up about that traumatic night isn't easy. I'm reliving the worst moment of my life. But I'm hoping that by sharing my pain, we can shine a light on the darkness of our nation's drug crisis. Maybe my story can help someone else find their way out of this nightmare. If you've lost a loved one to drugs, first off, I'm very sorry. I see you, I feel your pain, and I stand with you. Losing someone is never easy, and it feels like they're reduced to just a number. But each of those numbers represents a person, a life story. That's why Emily's Hope has set up morethanjustanumber.org, a place to remember your loved one, to tell their story, to celebrate their life beyond the cold statistics. If you want to honor your loved one, you can find the details on how to create a meaningful tribute on our podcast show notes. Let's turn these numbers into story, these statistics into lives remembered. We're in this together. Let's stand strong, share our pain, and turn our tragedies into a force for change.
And you learned what from the autopsy?
That she had 50 nanograms of fentanyl and 20 of acetylfentanyl.
She thought she was taking heroin?
Yes.
Yeah. And there was no heroin, all fentanyl?
There was absolutely nothing but caffeine, where she had probably a cup of coffee that morning. And, you know, and I tell people, too, she had a substance use disorder. Yes, she did. It was caused by a traumatic event that she could not get over. She could not get above. But she didn't do fentanyl. And yes, she had a substance use disorder, but that's how it took her life. Fentanyl is what took her life. That has just devastated me. The fact that, you know, I thought for the first time in my life that I could lay down and sleep. And actually, my child was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all this time, she had a small child.
Cameron was born in 2016. He was not quite 3 years old when heaven passed. Now, when he was born, at 3 weeks old, I took him.
You've been raising him since he was born?
Since he was 3 weeks old, yes.
So you are one of those grandparents out there, and I always talk about this. In fact, I interviewed a grandmother and a granddaughter who've been affected by drugs.
In episode 72, I sat down with Lana Olshaby and her granddaughter, Maddie. Maddie's dad is in prison for meth, and her mom, who also suffered from substance use disorder, was murdered by another man when Maddie was just 4 years old.
It's very sad because, like, all my friends, they're always, like, when we have, like, a sleepover or something, we go hang out, they're, like, when they make supper, they're all like, "Mom, Dad, can we have this or that for supper?" And I usually just say, "Nana, Lana, can we, what should we have for supper? And it's just sad not to use to say mom or dad.
Right. You feel different than your friends because you don't have that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes me sad too, Maddie, that you don't have that. But I am grateful that you have Lana because, I mean, it's important you have one person, that a child at least have one person in their life that they can trust and count on. And I know you have that.
Thankfully, Cameron has that support too with his grandmother. But that doesn't mean it's easy for either grandparents living without a child or the grandchildren living without their parents.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what I call them, the littlest victims of this epidemic.
How is your grandson doing today?
The older he gets, the more he realizes. Just last week, I always read him a bedtime story, you know, and we've done this since he was three. So, and I read him a bedtime story. And at the end of the bedtime story, there was a prayer. I started to read the prayer. And when I got to God, he looked at me and he calls me Mama too. He says, Mama, I don't want to talk about God right now. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because he has my mother.
Poor guy. But he has you. Thank God he has you.
And that's what I tell people.
It hasn't been easy for Patricia to not only take care of her grandchild, but also herself, following the death of her daughter. Like most grieving parents, Patricia has suffered not only mental anguish, but also physical pain.
3 months after having passed, I had a major panic attack here at work, and I quit breathing. I turned blue. They had to call EMS. And when I went to my doctor, he told me, he says, you know, broken heart syndrome is real.
In fact, we devoted an entire episode of Grieving Out Loud to broken heart syndrome. I highly recommend listening to this episode, number 10, if you've suffered a devastating loss. During that episode, Dr. Mark Vandenbroek, a board-certified music therapist and grief educator, talks about the symptoms of a broken heart.
Typically, the bottom half of your heart with a broken heart syndrome kind of, I don't want to say explodes, but ruptures. And if people are interested, the Japanese discovered this quite some time ago. And more, I see more and more of it nowadays.
Tell me exactly what happens. What
it's just the heart breaks. There's probably no better explanation of that. Your heart is broken. And we have found statistically that the first week after a death, I think there's close to a 10% likelihood of a spouse, for example, if you lose your husband by the end of the first week, your chances of death is quite high.
During the episode, Dr. Vandenbroek also discusses 4 ways that grief affects us and gives us tools for coping with significant loss. Meanwhile, Patricia thankfully has been able to recover, but she didn't feel physically well for weeks.
My esophagus completely slammed shut. I couldn't breathe out of my nose, my mouth, turned blue, about passed out. So yes, it is real.
And because of that, did you decide to do something?
I did. I threw myself into finding other parents that have been through the same thing. Because that was the one thing I remembered, is feeling so alone. Like I was the only person this had ever happened to. So I started making Facebook posts, asking about other people. Started, you know, hey, I'm going to make a banner, you know. So I did the 4 counties, surrounding counties, and I made my first banner. I made T-shirts with everyone's names on them. I had my first rally in 2020, a year after she had passed, and probably had 250, 300 people there. And from there, we have grown. I named the group Forgotten Victims because to me, that's what they are. They're forgotten by law enforcement. They're forgotten by society. They're forgotten by our government. They're forgotten by everyone but us, the grieving left behind.
I was going to say, we mothers are not going to let people forget. I think that's the thing.
Yes. So we now have 6 chapters across the state of North Carolina. Also, I have a friend that I have partnered with, Warren Walsh. She has Fentanyl Victims Networking of North Carolina. And she is the one that was responsible for, you know, they used to classify all the deaths as overdoses and clump them all together. Well, she is responsible for our state medical examiner for now separating the deaths from fentanyl. So we get all the stats for the state of just fentanyl deaths. So since 2013 in the state of North Carolina, we have lost 13,651. So that's 13,651 devastated families out there.
I'm sure mostly young people.
Yes, ma'am. Most of them were young. So, and I know what it did to me. Barb knows what it did to her, you know, and it just devastates your whole family foundation.
It's like a bomb being dropped in the middle of your family and your life.
Of their world.
Yeah, it really is.
You're right.
And what about laws? I know you've been working in your state to change some laws.
Yes, we push for the death by distribution law because, like in my daughter's case, for 4 years, I've been told this and told that, and absolutely nothing's happened.
No one's been charged.
No. And, you know, my mother is a better investigator than anybody in this world. Anything we want to know, we can and we will find out. So most of what has been found in her case, I found out. And that's not fair. You know, we do have some counties in the state of North Carolina that do prosecute. The neighboring county that has the same district attorney as the county my child died in has 5, I think, death by distribution prosecutions and several awaiting to be tried.
Is there a reason? Are you getting a reason from law enforcement why the person that you know?
The sheriff here says that it's really hard to prove these cases. But my thinking is if neighboring Franklin County can do it, why is it that my county that, you know, haven't died in, Bates County, why can't you do it? It shouldn't matter what county your child or your loved one passed in as to whether they received justice or not. The death by distribution law is the law for the whole entire state of North Carolina.
Patricia and other advocates pushing for stricter fentanyl regulations in North Carolina recently achieved another significant victory. The state's governor signed the Stop Counterfeit Pills Act, which makes it a felony to intentionally use a pill press to make a counterfeit controlled substance.
It's a felony to have the pill press. It's a felony to have the stamps. It's a felony to have the dyes to color the pills. Because I have a lot of friends whose kids, and a lot of them are teenagers, that have passed from pill.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to have stricter penalties for those caught peddling poison here in the state of North Carolina.
Have some of these efforts helped you in your grief, do you think?
They have helped me tremendously. You have to get busy. And that's what I did. I got busy because all I wanted to do was just sit and breathe. And it took me weeks before I could drive again. It was like I was afraid of everything. When I had that panic attack, I was sleeping in my car at night in the emergency room parking lot because I was afraid I was going to quit breathing. Her death just about devastated me. And that's one reason why I got busy too, is because I knew all these other families were out there feeling the same way.
Right. There's so many of us now. I mean, if you have 110,000 people dying of quote unquote overdose and 80% of those a year, that's the 2022 stats, and 80% of those are from fentanyl, I mean, multiply that by all their family members, you know, we're a big group now.
You're exactly right. You are. Yeah. And, you know, I saw a documentary the other day where they were talking about, you know, the children of those that we have lost and that they will be at a higher risk.
Like your grandson. Do you worry about him?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. And that is something else. I mean, Helen, if I couldn't reach out and put my hand on top of her head, she was too far away. But it still happened. You know, we talked every day. I knew where she was just about every moment. You know, where are you at? What are you doing? Hopefully we can eradicate it and won't be any fentanyl and won't be anything by the time he comes of age.
How do you think we do that? Eradicate it.
We need tougher policies as far as enforcement at the border, for one thing. We also need education. So a lot of parents still don't even know what fentanyl is. Stricter penalties for drug dealers. You know, the state law, death by distribution, is up to 20 years. But I don't see them giving them 20 years. You know, you're lucky if they get 3 to 5. Give them the 20, I say.
Yeah, there's a whole systematic problem there with prisons being overwhelmed and overcrowded. And we have a lot of issues. It's a very tangled web. That's the problem, I think, is that there's not one quick, easy solution. You hear seal up the borders, you know, don't let anybody through. But yet, I mean, yes, but yet fentanyl can get in through planes and ships. And we have to stop it at the root in China from being manufactured and sold. Although I have a feeling if we can stop it in China, that somewhere else like India or somewhere else will start manufacturing it. So I think we have to stop people from ever desiring these drugs in the first place. I think prevention is probably the most effective tool that we have. We have to do all these other things too. But I believe that prevention is the most effective tool. And I don't think our kids, I don't think our daughters knew what they were getting into the first time that they tried something. I know my daughter didn't know. I think it was just like, oh, these friends are doing this. This guy is doing this. My daughter also had a boyfriend who she was with since she was 16, who I later found out was addicted to heroin. And I didn't know that, but just broke up with him right before her death. So I think they were influenced by their peers, by their boyfriends or girlfriends or whomever. And then also they didn't know. They didn't really know that they were setting themselves up for this horrible disease.
No. And then plus once they do it, it's so addictive. And then, you know, they've been put in the supply line for so long now, and they're actually becoming addicted to that without even realizing it.
Right.
And that's even, you know, worse trying to get off of that than heroin.
Yeah.
Because what we're losing our future. And that's what I tell people, you know, I didn't just lose my daughter. You didn't just lose your daughter. The world lost them too. Because what could they have accomplished in life? What difference could they have made if not for fentanyl?
If not for fentanyl. And that's what I always say when I speak to students and groups. I show a big banner with dozens of young lives who have died. And I always say the lost potential. I say, who knows what music could have been written, what my daughter was an artist, what art could have been created, what businesses could have been started, what could have been invented. We will never know because these people never had a chance to live out their lives. Their lives were cut short unnecessarily.
Exactly.
Yeah. It really is murder, drug-induced homicide.
It is. They're being poisoned. They're being put to sleep. Just like you euthanize a dog is what's going on with our children.
Right. And people don't understand that addiction is a disease, substance use disorder. People think it's a choice. But just like now we're beginning to understand that obesity isn't a choice, right? That people's brains are wired to crave the food and to think about food all the time. It's the same with drug addiction or any kind of addiction for that matter.
Exactly.
Thank you for everything that you're doing in your daughter's name, just like I'm working in my daughter's name. And I think the thing that I always say when I meet other moms like myself is that we must join hands and work together, that we all have these little groups in our states, or so many people have started charities or nonprofits now or different groups. And we've got to band together because there's power in numbers. The power really lies in the numbers. And I think the more that we can do that and the more that we can connect with one another and fight for our children who can no longer fight for themselves and fight for other people's children. That's the thing.
Exactly right. And that's what we say here in North Carolina. No one stands alone. You're not alone.
Right. Right. Well, thank you for sharing this story. And thank you for all the work you're doing in North Carolina.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Grieving Out Loud. If you found it helpful, we'd appreciate it if you left us a positive review, 5 stars, and shared it with friends and family. It does help further our mission to increase awareness about substance use disorder, decrease the stigma surrounding addiction, and hopefully then connect more people with the help they need. Tune in again next week for a new episode of Grieving Out Loud when we hear from a woman who bravely shares her story of going from a college graduate with a thriving career to facing homelessness and heroin addiction. It's an episode you won't want to miss and may give you a new perspective into how our drug crisis has become so severe. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage. This podcast is produced by Casey Wannenberg-King and Anna Fye.